deep into the archives of Unraveling Religion, we found this 2008 talk with Reverend Keoki Roberts, the first priest of the Zen Center of Pittsburgh's Deep Spring Temple. In this talk, Keoki explores the nature of long-time Zen practice. What is the nature of self? What is Zen, including Dogen Zenji's dropping away body and mind? This talk came out of awareness that Reverend Keoki Roberts' passing, December 19th, 2023. Included in this talk is the original introduction from 2008. I hope you enjoy. Tonight's guest will be Reverend Keoki Roberts, who is a Soto Zen Buddhist priest, a founding member of the Order of Prairie Wind. She is trained in monasteries in Minnesota, San Francisco, and in Japan. Keoki received Dharma transmission from her teacher in June 2001, and she was appointed to serve as Deep Spring Temple's first head priest. She serves on the board of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association and the program committee of the American Zen Teachers Association.
Yeah, been busy here. Lots of going on. We have a big garden here, so we have 14 acres to take care of. So the summertime is always lots of activities, you know, taking care of the property. We have a bit patio we're trying to put down and to brick in, and a roof to put on. There's always lots. So we're very fortunate. We sit way up on top of a hill with stunning views. You come in on the dead end road and have a 180 degree view of the Western Pennsylvania hills. 5-10 miles away anyway. So it's just drop dead beautiful and changes through the seasons. And you know, we have the fog going through the valleys, and it's just a magnificent place to live.
I was wondering if you could give a little explanation of what Zen is.
Zen is the Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese character that was their closest approximation to sounding the word jhana, which means meditation. And that's a Sanskrit word. Zen is really a form of Buddhism that started with Shakyamuni Buddha, a person who lived 2,500 years ago in India, who wanted to answer the question, what is all the suffering about as a human being? And what can we do about this suffering? And the word he used was dukkha, or uneasiness, dissatisfaction, that sense of that something is wrong in our world. And his name, Siddhartha Gautama, he raised quite well to do, and he wanted to answer this question, you know, somewhere, hopefully here in America, somewhere along the line of getting that third or fourth car or fifth TV or new seat, you know, the 1,000th CD that maybe one of us will recognize that, you know, one more might not make me happy. And
the question itself seems as pertinent today, even maybe more so or as much as it did then, doesn't it?
I think so. I think we've, as a world society, we've not begun to, you know, address the issue of what is happening here in the world and how to address this question. So he ultimately, and what Zen is the meditation technique that he developed about how to understand how is the world working, what is happening here, what's going on. And that meditation is carefully attending to the present moment, to be here, to be present, to use all of your senses, to allow thoughts to arise and pass away, to allow emotions to come up. And with that, when you do this practice, you have a direct insight about what is the nature of self and your relationship to everybody and everything else in the world. And that, then, that insight is what leads to the understanding. This is what he taught 2,500 years ago and ended up sweeping through all of India, Southeast Asia, China, Tibet, Korea, and Japan. And all those countries are basically have Buddhist origins, you know, the Buddhist underpinnings.
Can you speak to us a little bit about the practicality of Zen, the practical aspect of Zen practice, its benefits, maybe some things that you found in your own life?
We'll have to be careful here because we're about to step into what I call spiritual capitalism. And like the having been a business owner myself, I firmly believe, you know, in the concept of using this system that I'll put my efforts or work over here, and then I'll be able to purchase these items over here that I need for shelter and food and that type of thing. So I'm not denying the role of capitalism in our world. In Zen, you have to be very careful to make sure that you're not going to say, I'll do this practice in order to get this over here. And so I want to draw that line is very to be very clear about that. I think everyone wants to come in with this same concept that Siddhartha came in 2,500 years ago, which is that concept that something's wrong with my life. So I'm having a difficult time. What will resolve this issue for me? We'll walk that this line between wanting something to be different and I'll do this in order to get that, to get peace or happiness or whatever word we're using. And so the practical aspects of what goes on is from when you're at a Zen temple, the teacher's going to use Zazen, the meditation, so that you can have that direct experience for yourself. The real question is, how does that then get applied into everyday life? And so the Zen teacher has a whole toolbox by which to help different individuals with different characteristics take this into the workplace or take it into family life or washing the dishes. How do you get that understanding that comes that you yourself have come up with in the meditation? How do you apply that? And so we have a variety of tools that we use in order to do that. Son went to a Catholic high school, and one of his teachers was a Zen Buddhist priest. And he came out to my business one day and saw a book I was reading and said, well, that's very interesting. You really should read, and gave me a suggested reading. And then when I finished that, I said, oh, that's really good. Do you have any other recommendations? And he says, yes, there's a Zen master from Minnesota who comes to Omaha, and you should begin sitting with him and sit with him as often as you can. And I started that back in the early 80s, and I've been sitting ever since. What I loved about coming into, was first introduced to Zen practice, was that you're given this process, this meditative process, but you're not told any answers, you're not told what to believe, you're not given very much information. You're not told anything except here, please sit here, and please sit with a nice straight back, and allow your thoughts to come and go, and return to your breath. And that's pretty much it when you come into a Zen center. But it was the difficulties in my own life. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to resolve them. Your parents sort of teach us, now go to school and get good grades, and then you'll get into a good college, and then get good grades, and then you'll get a good job, and then it starts to get vague. Maybe you should marry and then have kids, and maybe then you'll be happy. It gets really vague in there. And so sometimes between the age of 21 and 41, we go, wait a second, what's going on here? And that seems to be the case for most people that come into Zen practice, is they've run up against some sort of wall that they don't know their way around. And in Zen, we tell them, well, sit here and you'll come to your own understanding.
So it really is experiential.
Very experiential. Very much so. Oh, it'd be, you know, you can't read a book about it. There are lots of Zen books out there. But it'd be like reading a book on how to ride a horse. There's something about getting on the horse itself. And even still, it'd be like, or playing a piano. You can bang on the piano, but it might help to have the teacher to explain how to ride that horse or how to play that piano. Maybe dancers, the artists of the world understand. They're used to working with teachers to help guide this. But the teacher is there to point things out, but you yourself have to do it. And so it's very interesting, interesting practice.
It seems a process also. It's
very process-oriented, yeah. Absolutely. So you're having I have a very specific process. I have specific tools to use. For instance, we were just sitting here a few minutes ago, and the new person was doing the timekeeping. And she thought it was okay to hit the bell a certain way. But if you want to hit the bell, it has to be hit exactly on the edge so you get the right tone. You can't just hit it any which way. And so the very precision of it means that she has to take her carefully attending to the present moment, that full engagement that goes on in Zazen, body, mind dropped away because you're dropping the concept of a separate self from the moment, to hitting that bell. And it's an activity which you have to bring 100% to. You can't have a thought about it. You can't be thinking about it. You just have to do it. You just have to hit just that spot to get the right tone. It has to be done at the right moment. So that kind of precision that goes into the paying attention when you and how you're hitting that bell. And so if I can get her to hit that bell just perfectly, just right there, at the right moment, at the right time, with the right strength, everything right there, that full engagement in it, then we wake up. Everybody wakes up right there at that moment. And a moment from now, we have to hit the bell again, or we have to leave the Zendo, or we have to put the candle out, or we have to wash the dishes, or...
Would you feel comfortable speaking a little bit about the Soto Zen?
I can speak more about Soto than I can Rinzai, because I've never practiced Rinzai Zen. But I can tell your audience a little bit about some of the differences. And again, this is ended up being developed in China, that each teacher was trying to find, how do you get somebody to see the world in a little different way? And so different techniques were developed to help the students wake up from that normal, everyday sort of walking through the world that sort of stupidly like we usually do. And the Rinzai system developed what's called a koan, or public case. And these public cases are used to create a conundrum that you cannot resolve using your mental capacity. So the popular one that I heard of even growing up was, what is the sound of one hand clapping?
Sure, I think that was made famous by J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye.
Right. So there's a classic sort of one that's out there. The one that's usually most beginners are given in Rinzai Zen, as I understand, is, does a dog have Buddha nature? And the answer is mu, which means no or nothing. And you have to then express somehow to the teacher your understanding of that koan. And then you're going to go back to your cushion and use the meditation to come to a different understanding about that koan, that public case. And so from an experience in the meditation, you'll be able to express something to your teacher. What the teacher is trying to force there, then, is a different way of looking at the world. And we normally look at the world by, there's a me here, and there's an other than me there. And so there's, in my current view of the world, the other than me is a tree outside my window or a voice on the other side of the telephone. But the voice on the other phone or the tree is an image created in my mind and a story that I tell. And your voice there is actually vibrations in my eardrum, and I'm telling a story about what they say and what they mean. Very useful in everyday language, but maybe not exactly what the way the world is.
What you're saying is that we're trying to see things as they are.
As they are, absolutely. And so people would say my desk is hard, and yet that's changed the sense organ from my fingertips to electron microscope, and it's vast space all moving, and it doesn't have a quality of hardness. And so what is its reality? My dog doesn't call it a desk. It doesn't. So it functions as a desk, but it's not a, that's not its quality.
Its ultimate quality, yeah.
And so what is it then? And if you were in Korean Zen, they may say, what is it is the koan. Soto Zen tends to say, okay, sit over there, shut up and don't move. And what staring at a wall for, 40 minutes is sort of standard length of time, and then 10 minutes of walking meditation, another 40 minutes. Then maybe do that for 5 days in a row or seven. That process of doing this on a daily basis will ripen a koan in and of itself for you that you can't get around. That's what it appears to do. But no matter what, even if it's not doing that, you cannot sit Zazen without having the direct experience for yourself of that body-mind dropped away is the phrase that's used, that where you could see yourself as separate from everything else. So you'll have the direct experience, even at the very first moment that you sit, you'll be having the direct experience of this, self, no self happening. But it may not be at the cognitive level. Once it's got up at the cognitive level where you're thinking about it, you're already back on the selfing side of the world again, having a discussion, having a description, a talk about it. But that didn't mean you not having the experience of no self happening. And so Soto Zen is very interesting and very subtle, because this, you're having an experience without it getting up at the mental level. And so that's the difference that's going on in the practice. And then Soto Zen puts so much emphasis on this daily practice of sitting. And then all these little aspects, these little tools that I have to get you to pay attention to all the different activities that are going on.
What is it to awaken? What do we awaken to?
We're awakening to this way the world actually is. And it's this mistake that we have of seeing it as separate from ourselves.
Making it ours, in a sense, we change the way that we act in it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's like the left hand and right hand all of a sudden woke up one day and said, oh my goodness, we actually belong to the same body.
Right.
And it's literally that. It seems silly when it's your own body, but what if the whole universe you saw, you understood it as you, then you act in a totally different way.
One of my favorite pieces of writing is from the Zen master Dogen,
mm-hmm.
when he speaks about parental mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this ties nicely into what we're talking about, that this notion that sort of tending to everything and everyone, all life, with this kind of parental care, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because you're not like a parent and child. You don't see yourself as that child is somehow separate from you. And yet the child is. So we can't completely switch over to the fact that it's, that there's not a me here and a you on the other end of the phone.
Right.
And so it is that parental mind that's going on with, that Dogen's trying to point out. And Dogen, of course, is the person who brought Soto Zen from China into Japan in the 13th century.
And his teacher was a man who was older and who was a cook, right? We found him when he was picking mushrooms or something.
That's part of the story that goes. And actually, the cook was one of the people who was in the monastery where Tendo Nojo was doing the teaching, and gave the cook position, which is that we have to take such beautiful care of each activity. And this is where Soto Zen has really is how to take the understanding of the intimacy of this universe, this parental mind, into each activity that we're doing. So how you wash the mushrooms, you know, however, in that case, how they're dried, they become such a central part of our activities. So derived from that, how we wash our dishes, you know, do we leave them in the sink, or do we wash them and put them away? Study the ways, the study of the self. The study of the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things.
Yeah.
And so what happens is when we drop the looking at the world from the side of me, then everything else is able to express itself. We've dropped our agenda of trying to control the universe and make it happen a certain way. Spend our entire life trying to rearrange the world.
It seems inherent in the human condition, this desire to do that. It is a catch-22 of sorts, you know what I mean? That the ego is built in.
The first noble truth is alive and well. The first noble truth of Buddhism is life as a human being is conditioned by this dissatisfaction, this uneasiness by dukkha.
Yeah.
And so that's not going away. The four noble truths are going to be there, despite the third noble truth, which is that you can put an end to this. The suffering, this uneasiness, this dissatisfaction is from greed, wanting things we don't have, and anger or aversion, pushing away things that we don't want, and delusion. All three come from this sense of the separate self, of their me,
right.
And that I'm protecting it. When you do the meditation, that drops, and you immediately put the end to the suffering. Now, the problem is that's not a fixed and permanent state.
Right.
And there's not something called enlightenment that, oh, now I'm enlightened, and I'm enlightened, and my life is perfect, and I never have any problems. And I'm not sad if my child dies. Oh, isn't that just fine? Well, that's not going to happen in this world. Because when the people that are closest to us die or are sick, we should care. We should be engaged with them. We should want to help them. And so
tend to them, yeah. Tend to them.
And we should want to tend to them.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we know that by entering into that, you know, those deep, caring relationships, it will cause a great deal of suffering, and yet we should do that. And we can put an end anytime we want by not seeing ourselves as separate.
What is the Buddhist view of the afterlife, the Zen view of the afterlife?
Well, we live right in this moment. This moment is right here, being born and dying, right now. So just at this spot. So I think the best answer is no birth, no death. How can you speak about this moment and put some sort of conditions around it and say it's a certain length of time? Then it's just our mental activity in organizing the world, trying to cut it up into bits and pieces. There's not, you know, historically in Buddhism, there's no story of what happens after you die. The real question is, and here's where, you know, Zen Buddhism probably differs from other forms of Buddhism, is putting the emphasis on, doesn't matter what happens next week. We have to address the issue. Here's where we live our life.
Right.
You don't get to become a brilliant, wonderful human being next week and then take care of this issue. You have to take care of this issue that's come up in front of you with whatever you got right here and right now.
That's what, for people with a Christian bent, Jesus was saying when he said, let the morrow take thought of itself, essentially that it is here and now.
Yes.
And in Judaism is set on living life in this world, here and now.
That's right.
Yeah.
the, and so we don't get into that story. If you take care of this moment, if you drop this sense of separateness, you'll take care of this moment, I think, very beautifully. I think our original nature is this interconnectedness, and the only way to act is through kindness. If we take care of this moment, then when the next one shows up, we'll take care of that one. And, you know, when I take my last breath, I'll trust that my very next thing I'll do is say, okay, how do I help here? What do I do now? What's helpful in this situation?
My question is really, how do I reconcile this with a belief in a creator or God?
So the experience in Zazen of non-separateness then creates a problem around a God that is some guy sitting out there, that it's a five-year-old we're taught about. But when I talk to a Catholic sister, and she says, you know, that, well, when you finished drying the dish, did you just drop it on the floor, or did you put it back where it belonged? And she'll ask you that question, and she'll say, well, that's God, because you put it back where it belonged. And so the question is, of course, is what is God? This activity, this with this functioning of the universe without the separateness of occurring between you and the dish, you therefore are manifesting or creating God, or God is creating you, whichever way you want to turn that at that moment.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about Bodhidharma and his importance in in the transmission of mind to mind from mind.
Mm-hmm. Bodhidharma is a pretty interesting one, because Buddhism had spread into China and been there for probably, you know, a few hundred years anyway. We're not positive about, you know, all the dates that are floating around. But there seemed to have been quite a bit of activity, and so so historically, this person came in and is with Zen Buddhism talks about its start. It really talks about Bodhidharma as being sort of the starting of what we call Zen Buddhism, and there's a great story about him that. The emperor hears about this great monk who's just showed up. And now this emperor had, you know, done all kinds of lousy things to climb to the top of the game here in China. And so the emperor was sort of feels guilty now that he's, you know, murdered thousands of people on his way up the ladder. And so he says, well, maybe I should be a good Buddhist and I'll build all these temples and I'll pay for people to translate sutras, and I'll really support a bunch of monks. So then he hears about this great monk coming to town, and he says to them, oh, come over here, I'd like to meet you. And I'd like to know how much merit have I gained by supporting monks in the translations and building the temples. And Bodhidharma says, no merit. What's happening here? What is this? No merit. I thought that's the system we were playing with. That if I do good things, then that, you know, I'll stack up these merits. But Bodhidharma says, no merit. Emperor Wu is not a dumb cluck here. He says, well, then what is the highest truth? And Bodhidharma says, nothing higher or nothing holy, no holy truth. Now, wait a second. This is basic Buddhism. What do you mean? What's going on here? Mind that differentiates and puts one up and one down. That's our ordinary, everyday mind. And so Bodhidharma cuts that mind off that wants to separate all the things into bits and pieces and then assign them into categories as one is good, one is bad, one is better. You know, cut all that off. So then Emperor Wu gets that and then says, who are you? And Bodhidharma says, don't know. So how are we going to be in the world then? This moment has never happened before. We don't know ahead of time. We can't figure it out ahead of time, what we should or shouldn't do. We have to step into this moment fresh, brand new, completely. How do we do this? with this understanding, not out of delusion, not out of stupidity, but knowing that we're interconnected with everything. Now what do we do? How do we respond? How do we act in this moment? That's never happened before. So we have to bring compassion, the kindness, and we have to bring wisdom together and act. Step into the moment, right here.
It's always interesting to hear the tales of how the succession of the patriarchs came to be, because he was the first patriarch, and then...
Wonderful teaching stories about how it is. The first one was Wicot, he's there, he's trying to figure out how to do it, and, you know, he has no idea, and he can't get the attention of Bodhidharma sitting in there staring at the walls. He can't get an answer to his questions. And he's standing out in the snow, supposedly, and his arm freezes, and he cuts it off and throws it at them. And I think, metaphorically, anybody who wants to do spiritual practice, I don't care what the spiritual practice is, anybody who goes deep enough has to cut off, their old life.
Yeah.
And leave things behind that they treasured and cared for and wanted and had hoped for, and they have to leave those old ideas behind and step into something brand new and different.
Yeah. I used to struggle with the question, what is the matter with me?
Right.
And which is a wonderful, wonderful question.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. I think that's the American question, isn't it?
That is very much a very, and it is just such a, because that is our dilemma is, and that's our salvation in the same breath,
yes.
What I mean? Yeah.
Right. I think I would like to add that we've been talking about Zen Buddhism, but the real question is who am I? What's happening here? What's going on? And it's really, really important that we all make that investigation for ourselves and for our children, for the people we care about, for the people we work with. What is happening here? And there are a variety of spiritual practices which will lead you deeper into this.
And almost every religion has some form of this in its teachings, right?
Especially the contemplative pieces of the puzzle lead to a very deep understanding about this, the nature of self.
Yeah.
And when we make that investigation, then if we completely turn our lives, we just turn our lives. I'm trained as a scientist. I love to investigate the question of what's going on here, happening. I'm just curious. I want to know more. I'm not content with just sitting back and being accepting the information that I'm handed. I want to question it. And I think that's so important that all of us are called to do.
Yes. Could I just segue into talking a little bit about the notion of the Bodhisattva?
The Bodhisattva has been in pre-Buddhist thought even. Was the concept is an awakening being, as somebody who's there to help all beings wake up. And this got elevated in Buddhism, in Mahayana, Great Vehicle Buddhism, sort of Northern Buddhism, if you will, that as soon as you've had this experience, this understanding of your interconnectedness with all beings, and you know this connection and have it completely as who you are, then your only response is, how can I be helpful in this moment? What's helpful? What would be helpful? And that is the Bodhisattva vow, is to step into this moment with that concept. What's helpful here? So my little joke is, I hear people tell me, "Well, you're going to go to hell," and I said, "Well, as I understand, right, heaven doesn't need any help." And so, the question is, where can it be helpful? So maybe something horrible in our past that we've done or has been done to us has happened. The vow is to take that experience and then use it to benefit rather than to, than the great deal of harm that may have caused. So no matter what the our history or background is, we can take that and use it to be helpful. Or may we have a much deeper understanding about the loss of someone we care for if we lost our child.
Yeah.
And so this horrible event, and you can either sink into, you know, depression and misery and a horrible life, or you can say, I'm going to turn that. I'm going to use that death to be helpful for other people and other beings.
Right. It reminds me of the Jewish phrase, Gamzu Letova, which means this is also for the good, which was the name of a sage who many things befell him, and every time he would say, whether it was good or bad, Gamzu Letova, this is also for the good.
This is also for the good.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's the turning that we're talking about in this way of living your life, is which it doesn't matter what happens to you. We have the ability to turn that and use it for benefit, to be helpful. And that's the vow of the Bodhisattva.
Is there a prayer or a chant that you'd like to close with?
Well, the most famous one in Buddhism, of course, is the Heart Sutra, and which speaks about this form and emptiness, and that the concept of seeing ourselves as a me, a natural, I'm Kyoki and you're Joel, and actually the functioning that's occurring at the present moment, Kyoki and Joel are the same, and there's hearing and listening and answering and questioning all going on together. I think that most important thing, though, is that we need to acknowledge. And the way we start out our morning service every morning here, after we get up from our hour and a half of meditation, we say a repentance verse, and I think that's really important. I'd like to say that.
Please.
So all my past and harmful karma means action. So all my past and harmful actions, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, the three poisons of Buddhism. And this comes from through body, speech, and mind. So my actions with my body, the things I say, and also my thoughts, I now fully avow. So all my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So this first thing that I'm going to start my service with in the morning is acknowledgement that all my history has brought me to this point.
Yes.
And to not deny any of it. I think that's really important. We then take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddha is the historical Buddha, but Buddha is all beings as well. It can also mean the particular teacher that you are working with. They take refuge in Dharma, and Dharma is the teaching, but the teaching is not only the historical teachings that have been handed down to us, but is the teaching of what's happening in this moment with each other.
The playing out of karma.
And I take refuge in Sangha, and the Sangha is the community. So to take refuge then in the family that we're living with, the people that we're working with, or the actual Buddhist community that we're living in. And then we end up with the four vows after that. And the four vows are the Bodhisattva vows. And beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. So it's a set of four impossible tasks that we promise to do. And so a very, very important piece of my puzzle is doing a morning service. of the sutras that we use here on an everyday basis. And these are religious texts that have been handed down for the last couple thousand years. So there are some very ancient ones that have been proven to be very important to pointing out, you know, a way of looking at the world that is from this place of dropping that concept of a separate self.
I really appreciate your time, Keoki.
Sir, all the people who are listening, may you be free from suffering and the conditions that give rise to suffering. May you be well.